is underway of how families are involved in that process. But is some kind of coordination or family interaction ahead of a raid even possible moving forward?
Well, part of the review that the president has ordered does involve the communication between the federal government and the families that are in this terrible situation. And as I mentioned earlier, our thoughts and prayers are with the Summers family. It's difficult to comprehend the level of grief they must be feeling today. The only practical time in which this raid could be carried out would have been Friday night. And that's why the president acted quickly. That's why our special operators acted quickly. That's why we worked quickly with the Yemen government to ensure that this was well coordinated. That's what was necessary in order to try to save his life.
So, well, I mean, I know we don't want to talk about hypotheticals, but if there was, say, in this case, a longer time frame to work with, is consultation with the family something that would be considered?
That's difficult to say, Michelle, because it's each situation is different and each situation is unique. There obviously are significant operational security concerns when you're carrying out a raid like this, that the element of surprise is critically important, not just for the success of the operation, but also for the safety of the operators. So the amount of information that can be shared with anybody is very limited. That would have an impact on what is communicated to the family, but it's not necessarily determinative in terms of what is eventually communicated to them.
That was Josh Earnest, White House Press Secretary, talking with reporters today about the failed U.S. attempt to rescue American hostage Luke Summers in Yemen early Saturday.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Monday, December 8, 2014. Palestinian man dies of wounds in Jerusalem and Israeli Navy attack Palestinian fishermen off Gaza coastline. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A Palestinian man has succumbed on Sunday to wounds sustained during a car attack on light rail station in East Jerusalem. 60-year-old Abdel Karim Hamid was injured when a Palestinian slammed his car into a Sheikh Jarrah tram station, killing a Druze officer in the Israeli border police and injuring at least 13 people, local media reported. Mr. Hamid suffered multiple fractures to his spine and feet and subsequently had a heart attack. According to his wife, he did not receive the necessary medical treatment right away. She said that, according to eyewitnesses, her husband arrived at Sha'ar Tzedek Medical Center handcuffed. Elsewhere, Israeli soldiers kidnapped on Monday at least 16 Palestinians in different parts of the occupied West Bank, including a woman who was kidnapped in the yards of Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied East Jerusalem. Earlier on Monday morning, small groups of Israeli fanatics accompanied by special police forces broke into the yards of Al-Aqsa Mosque through the Mughrabi Gate. The police also continued its policy of withholding the ID cards of young Palestinian men and women before allowing them to enter the mosque. Furthermore, Israeli military bulldozers uprooted a Palestinian land near Jalbua village south of Nablus in preparation to extend two illegal settlements built on Palestinian lands. On Sunday, at least 15 Palestinians, including five minors, were taken captive by Israeli army and police during breedon raids across the occupied West Bank and Jerusalem. In Gaza, Israeli gunboats stationed in the Gaza Sea have again chased down and opened fire on Palestinian fishing boats sailing within the officially allotted fishing zone. According to local news sources, forces arrested 12 fishermen, confiscated 5 boats, and damaged fishing equipment. All the fishermen were abducted and taken to unknown destination, their boats and fishing nets confiscated and equipment damaged. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, December 8, 2014 News Roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imenc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Banoura.
Russian President Vladimir Putin and the Prime Minister of Turkey have announced plans to build a new natural gas pipeline from Russia through Turkey to the southern border of Greece. The new pipeline would replace the South Stream pipeline that was scheduled to be built from Russia to Europe. The South Stream pipeline would have run under the Black Sea near Crimea and through Bulgaria before ending at a terminal in Italy. Political tensions between the EU and the Russian government over the Ukrainian Revolution and economic sanctions leveled on Russia by the West led Russia to pull the plug on the South Stream pipeline. In announcing the new pipeline deal with Turkey, Russia cited what they considered to be politically motivated obstacles to the South Stream pipeline as a prime reason for the new route through Turkey. The new deal threatens to worsen the already fragile political relations between the United States and Turkey. In related news, the U.S. House of Representatives has passed House Resolution 758 condemning Russia for its actions in Ukraine. The House resolution urges President Obama to increase economic sanctions on Russia, including issuing visa bans and freezing the Western-held assets of Russian citizens and businesses. It also calls on the European Union to not recognize the Russian annexation of Crimea. The resolution recommends that the Obama administration review the readiness of the U.S. and NATO military forces in Eastern Europe and for the Obama administration to send military supplies and intelligence to Eastern Europe and the Ukraine. In response, Russian President Putin claims the U.S. wishes to break up Russia along the lines of Yugoslavia, and Russia will never allow that. Former U.S. Congressman Dennis Kucinich condemned the House resolution and called it a declaration of Cold War against Russia.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Don Zur, Joanna Peterson, Riley Turner, Ken Jones, and Dan Richardson. Special thanks to Yana Maximova in Lima, and to Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kitzhaber's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Joanna Peterson. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Joe Uris and Abe Proctor host the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. At 9, on Alternative Radio, Professor Michael Schwartz speaks on oil and gas wars. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Stage and Studio, host Sarika Mehta speaks with actor and writer Asif Mandavi, senior Muslim correspondent on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, Joseph Galvin interviews Julia Dolan, the curator of photography at the Portland Art Museum, about the show Blue Sky, the Oregon Center for the Photographic Arts at 40. Thanks, KABU members, for your generous support in our recent membership drive. Thanks to you, we exceeded our goal. And stay tuned now for KABU News in Depth, featuring an interview about today's direct action in Washington, D.C. to oppose the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Good night, Ken.
Good night, Joanna. Good night, Danielle.
KABU News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
The Niger Delta community have been terribly impacted. They have ruined the...
We are joined on the line now by Cassidy Regan. She's with Flush, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Cassidy, can you start off by telling us about today's action outside of the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative?
Absolutely. So today I was kicked off with a handful of folks sitting outside the U.S. Trade Representative's office starting at 8 a.m., greeting the negotiators from the different countries, letting them know that we will not stand for continued secretive negotiations around this agreement that could impact so many aspects of our lives. And at noon, more and more, in fact, several hundred protesters joined in with a march and rally outside of the office to make it clear to the negotiators that Fast Track, another secretive aspect of the TPP, which would lessen congressional oversight of that agreement here in the United States, would not be passed either. So the theme of the day was to sort of let the negotiators know that opposition to the TPP and to Fast Track legislation is alive and well here in the United States, and that we won't stand for these harmful and secretive agreements.
What are some of the most egregious issues that appear to be in this Trans-Pacific Partnership?
It's hard to know where to begin, but a good one is something called investor-state dispute resolution, which is a sort of corporate trade tribunal which allows corporations to sue governments for policies that interfere with their profits. This is a mechanism that has been part of past free trade agreements and has led to absolutely egregious cases in which governments are sued for millions of dollars when they take action and create policies to protect community resources. There have been cases against El Salvador when it comes to blocking mining permits. There was a case against Quebec when they attempted to put a moratorium on fracking. There have been cases around the labeling of cigarette boxes, around public health concerns, and that's just a particularly terrifying aspect of the TPP when considering how large this agreement is. So that's really something that threatens our ability to protect ourselves even after this agreement were to go through. Aside from that, we're really concerned about the potential for rising costs of medicines, because the intellectual property chapter leaked by WikiLeaks showed that there could be extensions of drug patents for large pharmaceutical companies. We're also really concerned about internet freedom and the way that this agreement would increase internet policing by service providers. We're really concerned about what it would mean for jobs. You see no indication in this agreement that it will be any different from past free trade agreements, which lost millions of jobs here in the United States and outside of it. And the list really just goes on and on.
Locally, we've got some issues like Jackson and Josephine County in southern Oregon. Both of those counties have passed bans on genetically modified organisms, and right now there's a recount going on whether GMOs will be labeled statewide. Would that be the type of issue that would be challenged under this Trans-Pacific Partnership as a barrier to trade for a corporation?
that is exactly the kind of policy that would be challenged under the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We know that Monsanto has been one of 600 corporate advisors with active access to the text of the TPP, and they're certainly pushing against labeling along these lines. So exactly, those kinds of policies meant to inform consumers, meant to encourage local industry and buying local, are all policies that could be threatened under the TPP.
Right now, headlines across the country are focused on police violence, issues of racism. Does it seem that this round of trade negotiations is going on kind of under the radar and unreported?
It really is a struggle to bring free trade into the light because it is something that those supporting have really attempted to keep hidden. I mean, the negotiations have happened in secret. It's the first trade agreement text to be kept classified from the public. As you said earlier, all we know is through WikiLeaks. So it really is difficult when we've got so much against us to bring this to light. However, at the same time, we know what kinds of impacts these free trade agreements have, and momentum really has been building over the past year, not only in the United States, but in Japan, in Malaysia, in New Zealand, in Peru, and in other countries who would be affected by the free trade agreement. And I know that I really do believe that the white supremacy that underlines police brutality here in the United States is also the kind of white supremacy and brutality that you see reflected in these detrimental and imperialist free trade agreements that really threaten local economies everywhere and make corporate rule that which comes above all else.
You mentioned Peru. Right now in Lima, there are climate talks going on in which countries from around the world are trying to come up with some sort of goal for carbon reductions. How will that interface with the Trans-Pacific Partnership if it goes through? Will the two be in conflict?
That's another really difficult aspect of these free trade agreements, is that there's really huge potential for environmental protections that exist on national, state, and local levels to actually be rolled back should countries agree to the provisions